Hello and welcome to another special bonus episode of Damn Interesting Week. This bonus episode is all about our dangerous planet and the many impressive ways it has to try and kill us while still somehow being the most habitable planet we've ever found. So if you're suffering under a heat dome this week, or a tornado warning, or even a volcanic advisory, we hope you enjoy this reminder that it could always be worse. My name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Whisper Chen.
And these were some damn interesting weeks.
First Link!
This article comes to us from TheGuardian.com and is titled End of Neanderthals Linked to Flip of Earth's Magnetic Poles, study suggests.
This is one of those things that freaks me out because, like, you know, it's like we're overdue for it, and I'm constantly imagining doomsday scenarios where the pole flips and, like, all of our electrical grids go down, everything goes to chaos.
Yeah, well, I don't think this article is going to make you feel better.
Good. All right, cool.
I mean, we're due for a lot of that stuff, you know, poles flipping, the big one in California.
Yeah, Yellowstone. It's all going to go to hell.
All that stuff, yeah. So let's get into it.
All right.
researchers say the flipping of the Earth's magnetic poles together with a drop in solar activity 42,000 years ago could have generated an apocalyptic environment that may have played a role in major events ranging from the extinction of megafauna to the end of the Neanderthals. So, recap, the Earth's magnetic field acts as a protective shield against cosmic radiation, which is very damaging, but when the poles switch, as has occurred many times in the past, the protective shield weakens dramatically and leaves the planet exposed to high-energy particles. One temporary flip of the poles, known as the Lachance excursion, happened 42,000 years ago and lasted for about 1,000 years. Oh. Previous work found little evidence that the event had a profound impact on the planet, possibly because the focus had not been on the period during which the poles were actually shifting. Professor Chris Turney of the University of New South Wales and co-author of the study says it probably would have seemed like the end of days. The team has collectively termed this period the Adams Event, a nod to Douglas Adams, author of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, in which 42 was said to be the answer to the ultimate question of life, the universe, and everything.
Because it's 42,000 years ago. Yeah. I like that.
There you go.
Yeah. Writing in the journal Science, Turney and his colleagues describe how they carried out radiocarb analyses of the rings of ancient kauri trees preserved in northern New Zealand wetlands, some of which were more than 42,000 years old. This allowed them to track over time the rise in carbon-14 levels in the atmosphere produced by increasing levels of high-energy cosmic radiation reaching the Earth during the Lachance excursion. As a result, they're able to date the atmospheric changes in more detail than offered by previous records, such as mineral deposits. They then examined numerous records and materials from all over the world, including from lake and ice cores, and found that a host of major environmental changes occurred at the same time as the carbon-14 levels peaked. Turney says, we see this massive growth of the ice sheet over North America, we see tropical rain belts in the West Pacific shifting dramatically at that point, and then also wind belts in the Southern Ocean and a drying out in Australia. The researchers also used a model to examine how the chemistry of the atmosphere might change if the Earth's magnetic field was lost, and there was a prolonged period of low solar activity, which would have further reduced Earth's protection against cosmic radiation. Ice core records suggest such dips in solar activity, known as the Grand Solar Minima, coincided with the Lachance excursion. And the results reveal that the atmospheric changes could have resulted in huge shifts in the climate, electrical storms, and widespread colorful aurora. So at least, you know, things look pretty while everything is exploding. And as well as the environmental changes potentially accelerating the growth of ice sheets and contributing to the extinction of Australian megafauna, the team suggests they could also be linked to the emergence of red ochre handprints, the suggestion being that humans may have been using the pigment as a sunscreen against the increased levels of ultraviolet radiation hitting the Earth as a result of the depletion of the ozone.
That's really fascinating, because that's something that they've noted before is, like, all of a sudden in the historical record, people, like, widely spread out started doing these red handprints in the cave paintings. And they're like, who came up with that idea? Why is that suddenly everyone's idea at the same time? But if you've got that junk all over your hands, that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And when I think about, you know, any time I think of hand cave paintings, it's like the red hand.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Iconic at this point. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Neanderthals, I guess. they also suggest the rise in the use of caves by our ancestors around this time, as well as the rise in cave art. Might be down to the fact that underground spaces offered shelter from the harsh conditions.
Oh.
And the situation may have also boosted competition, potentially contributing to the end of the Neanderthals. The Earth's magnetic field has weakened by about 9% over the past 170 years, and the researchers say another flip could be on the cards, and such a situation could have a dramatic effect, not least by devastating electricity grids and satellite networks.
Yeah.
And I'll also mention that we are soon approaching, or already in, another solar minima.
Mm-hmm.
We're at a very low historical sunspot point right now. And that's something to think about.
See, and here's the thing, like the Neanderthals already had those survival skills. Like they knew how to hunt. They knew how to live on the land and start a fire and whatever. I don't know how to do any of that stuff. I'm completely reliant on electricity, as this past week has shown all of us in Texas.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like, we're not even going to last for a week. At least the Neanderthals took 1,000 years to die out over this process.
Right.
Like,
mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I don't know where the nearest cave is.
Yeah.
I don't know how to get red ochre.
That's
like,
right.
Come on. So Richard Horne, the head of space, weather, and atmosphere at the British Antarctic Survey, who was not involved in the work, said that the chemical changes in the upper atmosphere predicted by the study chimed with what had been measured at Halley Research Station in Antarctica during strong but short-lived events in which energetic particles were emitted from the sun. Dr. Anders Svensson of the University of Copenhagen, however, said that ice cores from Greenland and Antarctica do not show evidence of any dramatic climate change that occurred around the time of the Lachambs excursion, but that did not rule out it having an impact. Chris Stringer, who studies human origins at the Natural History Museum in London, he said that the greater use of caves as shelter was plausible, but that the link to a rise in cave art was less convincing because paintings of pigs were apparently being produced in Sulawesi in Indonesia well before the Lachambs excursion. And they're really doing their due diligence here. Finally, Dr. Richard Staff, a research fellow in quaternary geochronology at the University of Glasgow, said the study was exciting and noted that it could lead to further investigation into the environmental and evolutionary effects of other large dramatic downturns in the Earth's magnetic field strength further back in time.
Well, that's good. So we're going to know exactly how we're going to die out when we die out.
Yeah, exactly. Which, depending on how you interpret it, is either great or awful.
Yeah.
And I think that's very wholesome. Next link?
Next link.
All right. Well, this one has no traces of biscuits in it. It's from American Heritage. It's called Did Hurricanes Save America? So obviously we are in the middle of hurricane season. It's not a great one. I don't know if you guys read elsewhere. They're about to run out of letters.
Oh, delightful.
But yeah, so this one kind of goes into like, well, maybe there have been some times when hurricanes were not so bad. And apparently a hurricane may very well be the reason that America won the American Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
The hurricanes in question are two from the 1780 season, which was the deadliest on record. The first hurricane hit Jamaica and then kind of headed north to Cuba. And in the strait between Jamaica and Cuba, there were 7 British Royal Navy ships, including the 44-gun HMS Phoenix. Basically, almost everybody on all those ships died, but we have a little bit of records from it because a few people from the HMS Phoenix survived, one of which was First Lieutenant Benjamin Archer, who wrote this moving letter to his mother describing the horrors of going through this hurricane on the ocean, just trying to ride it out. He noted that birds fell out of the sky. And the ones that lived kind of huddled in flocks on the decks, like they would not leave the ship. So they had all these flocks of birds hanging out trying to protect themselves. He said the waves were as high as mountains on all sides. And eventually the ship ran aground basically high enough that they couldn't get off again. They were just up on this rock that was way away from where the normal sea level was. And between the north side of Cuba and southern Florida, it hit another fleet of British ships, damaging all of them. They weren't quite as destructive, but basically at this point, every British ship in the Caribbean was damaged or completely destroyed. And then only about a week later, a second worse hurricane hit, causing 17,000 civilian deaths in Barbados and Martinique and those kind of surrounding islands. And another 15 Royal Navy warships were lost.
Dang.
So the British lost a huge amount of Navy artillery and soldiers and everything right at the time when the war was maybe kind of tipping in their favor. Like at the end of the Revolutionary War, we were not looking so good. And then meanwhile, The French fleets were kind of hanging out in the same area, but they were a little farther north. They missed the hurricane. They lost about 40 transport ships and a number of soldiers, but they didn't lose any warships or guns, which is important. You may recall from history or Hamilton, the French were on our side, and they were fighting for us, but basically what they were really doing was fighting the British, which obviously the French and the British go way back.
Right.
And up until the hurricane season of 1780, they had viewed the Caribbean as the best front. That's where they were doing all their fighting. They had kind of been invited politely to come up to the east coast of the U.S. to fight there, but they were pretty much disinterested in that. And it wasn't until the hurricane season that they said, you know what? Actually, hanging out in the Caribbean is not a great idea. We need to get out of here. They headed north to the American fronts. And this was at the point where Washington's army was down to 3,500 soldiers, many of whom had not been paid in nearly a year. The British had held New York for 5 years at that point, and their southern army was decimating Virginia. And this was the moment when the French intervened at Chesapeake Bay. They had 26 ships versus the British 19, which had the British not just lost 15 ships, they absolutely would have outnumbered the French. They probably would have won that battle. And the fact that the French won that battle was what led to the Battle of Yorktown, which is where America won the war. So this historian makes a really compelling argument that we absolutely would not have won if these two hurricanes hadn't hit right when they did. In the season of 1780. So, you know, it's kind of crazy to think about the number of historical events that could turn on a dime like that through stuff completely out of our control. I mean, certainly at the time, they didn't have the ability to say, oh, a hurricane's coming. We got to get out of here. They really had no predictive abilities whatsoever, certainly compared to what we have today.
Just divine interference.
That's right. God wanted America to win. Yeah.
Yeah, I know a few people who would very much like to internalize this story.
That's right. Next link.
Next link.
Have you guys been suffering from this Saharan dust storm that's been kind of settling all over the U.S. and Texas?
No.
I've been inside, so no.
I haven't even paid attention to this.
Oh, yeah. It's been a thing, and I think this year it's had an especially heavy one. There's a great article from The Atlantic from Sabrina Imbler. A giant dust storm is heading across the Atlantic, but dust from the Sahara can fertilize faraway lands and seas, so the superstorm is kind of a mixed blessing. So we're basically, every year we get about 182 million tons of dust that leave the Sahara, and that's basically enough to fill about 689,000 semi-trucks. It's a lot of dust, y'all. Yeah.
Wow.
And this kind of cloud of dust can make up what they're terming the greatest annual migration on the planet. It's not an animal migration, but a mineral one. So basically, you know, it starts in the Sahara, the windstorms levitate these huge plumes of desert dust, and they go thousands of feet above the surface of the earth, and then they just hitchhike on trade winds traveling west across the Atlantic Ocean and Caribbean Sea. And the way that the dust falls and settles in the ocean, as well as rainforests and, you know, sometimes on our cars. So if you do go outside and go to your car and see it really dirty, that might be why. But the one that's happening right now over the Caribbean and heading towards the United States, and since the time of the publication of this article has hit the United States, it's unusual for a Saharan dust cloud, both in terms of volume and density. A researcher at the University of Puerto Rico notes it's the most dust we've seen in 50 or 60 years, which, you know, sounds on par for the kind of year that we're having.
Yeah.
But it's not all bad. Because there are so many minerals like iron and phosphorus in the dust cloud, it happens to fertilize some of the most biodiverse oases on the planet, including the Amazon rainforest.
I had no idea that there are minerals in, I mean, if you think about it, it makes sense, but you don't think of sterile seeming desert dust as being essential to neighboring ecosystems.
Right.
You don't think neighboring is a stretch, I think, if we're talking about the Sahara to the Amazon. I mean, these are going off across entire oceans.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I mean, I guess these nutrients and minerals come from an ancient time when the Sahara was a little more fertile and the weather there wasn't quite as dry as it is now. But I mean, how does that portend for, like, if the water ever does return? I guess the winds would also change at that point, and so it's all up in the air, but it feels like it's stripping nutrients from a place that really can't afford to lose anymore anyway.
Well, it may be that the nutrients are not necessarily being utilized because there's not a lot of plant material in the Sahara Desert.
Mm-hmm.
There are some negative effects of it happening over the ocean, however. So there are sea creatures that do enjoy the precious minerals, including, unfortunately, algae. So algae loves this kind of dust. It becomes a banquet for red tides, which is when blooms of algae spill into the ocean like dye. They deplete it of oxygen and then eventually release toxins. So dust clouds can also host unwelcome stowaways because they carry a diverse community of microorganisms, some of which have the potential to be plant pathogens or human pathogens.
Oh, good.
Womp, womp.
That's what we need.
Yeah, and some scientists are even suggesting that the dust storms can carry fungal spores or bacteria that can spread diseases in corals.
I'm never going outside ever.
It's just it.
Right, but it's not all bad. It's not all good. You know, even though it can spread diseases in corals, sometimes the seasonal sprinkling of Saharan dust can actually feed the corals encrusting the Bahamas, which are surrounded by waters that lack these nutrients that are required to create such an oasis. So it's a mixed bag, but humans obviously do not thrive in enormous dust plumes.
Well, I mean, like you said, it seems like it's something that happens every year and the ecosystem thrives on it. It's just that this year we happen to be getting a really big, extra dusty dust storm.
Exactly. And it does yield some really beautiful sunrises and sunsets. I know that in, you know, Southern California, where you've got a lot of smog and pollution, that kind of accounts for a lot of the rainbow watercolor sunsets and sunrises that you see. The Saharan dust can do the same thing. So like everything in nature, it is pretty much lawful neutral. It just does the thing. Some of it's good, some of it's bad, but it's all part of a system that we're still learning about.
And it could rejuvenate the car wash industry. I mean, they're suffering right now, too. So, you know, that might be useful for them.
The booming, booming car wash industry. Yeah. Next link.
Next link.
All right. Well, we have a little bit of a special treat here. Our next article was actually written by Alan Bellows.
Hey!
It has a little bit of a sad intro. It's kind of a bummer. Basically, in 1984, there was a truck of migrants passing through Cameroon, and it was kind of a misty night. And then for some reason, their engine just sputtered and died. And, you know, with the opportunity to sort of fix the truck and stretch their legs, everybody got out of the truck except for two who were riding on the very top up on the roof. And within moments, everyone who had gotten off the truck collapsed and died on the spot. And it was, in fact, as you might expect, a kind of poison gas. But it wasn't a terrorist attack. It was a natural phenomenon. A nearby lake had exploded.
What?
Whoa.
And unfortunately, they figured out what happened because it happened again at a different lake called Lake Nyos. So the first incident in Lake Monoon, 37 were dead, including the 10 on the truck. But at Lake Nyos, 1,800 died, plus another 3,500 farm animals.
Oh, my God.
This was enough to get national attention. And so the U.S. and other countries sent aid and scientists, and that's how they were able to sort of figure out what was going on. So the lake is very deep, but very narrow with these steep sides. And so what happens is that surface winds are not able to churn the water enough to get to the deepest layers. And the water becomes stratified where these cold layers at the bottom are undisturbed for decades or even centuries. And then the second key is that the lake sits atop a volcanic vent, that it's not a volcano that erupts, but it sort of slowly leaks carbon dioxide up through the rock. And the cold and the pressure of this particular lake shape keeps the carbon dioxide trapped in the super cold, lower, deeply pressured layers of the lake. So it just sort of sits there building and building. Then, like shaking a soda bottle, something moved. There may have been an earthquake or a landslide. Nobody really knows. But what happened was the water churned. Some amount of the cold layer was able to swirl up into the warmer layer, where it rapidly depressurized and began to rise. And, of course, this creates kind of an upward suction, which draws more cold water up into the warm layers. And ultimately, you get this chain reaction of an explosion just out of the middle of the lake, similar to like when you drop a Mentos into a Diet Coke bottle. It just is an unexpected, sudden explosion upward. That in itself isn't really enough to kill people. There's a little bit of a tsunami at the end of the lake. But the real problem is that what this is expelling is millions of tons of gas. And the gas is a mixture of carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide, plus some traces of hydrochloric acid, just for fun.
Oh. Yeesh.
And it's heavier than air. So it immediately settles back onto the ground and starts kind of slithering back down the hills toward the lake. And it poisons everyone who breathes it. If you're not on high ground, you're going to die. So that was sort of the explanation. They said another telltale sign is that within a day or two, the swirled lower water in the lake is very iron rich. And so as the water comes up along with the carbon dioxide, a whole bunch of iron is mixed into the upper layers. And once it's near the surface, it oxidizes. And so the lake that has just exploded turns rust red.
Oh my gosh.
Whoa.
And that was what happened both at Lake Nyos and at the earlier lake. They had references to the fact that Lake Monon had turned rust red as well after this inexplicable tragedy. So, you know, the scientists kind of determined what had happened, and they determined that the Lake Nyos explosion only released 2% of the gas that's held down in the depths.
Holy cow.
They can't fix it. They can't predict when the next explosion will occur. It's definitely going to occur again. I mean, this is just an inevitable thing. But unfortunately, they can't talk people into moving away from these lakes. You know, there's villages set up here, and they're, you know, basically these white scientists coming in and going, listen, we know something that's going to happen and you have to trust us. And they're like, no, we're not going to move. We have our whole lives here.
Yeah.
And since then, they've studied other lakes in the area because it's this whole volcanic system underneath this area of the country. And they found an even larger site at Lake Kivu in Rwanda. And the fossil record from the surrounding land indicates a massive biological die-off about every 1,000 years or so. I mean, this is clearly a lake that is set to explode at some point. And the danger here, of course, is if Lake Kivu explodes, about 2 million people would die. You know, Whoa. Again, this is them trying to convince locals this is a problem, you really need to move. And they're just saying, no, we'll take our chances. Which, you know, if you look at California, there's people who say, yeah, I'll take my chances on an earthquake. So I can't say...
Sure, or hurricane zones.
Yeah. So the government of Rwanda did install some large pipes that kind of reach all the way down to the bottom and constantly pump a set amount of cold water to the surface. And they look like little fountains. Like there's just this little circle in the middle of the lake that's just shooting water up constantly. But the scientists say it's not enough. It's not removing enough carbon dioxide. The threat of explosion is still very much there.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a relevant subject of study, even outside of volcanic regions, because one of the, quote, big ideas for climate change is to capture CO2 in the atmosphere and force it to the bottom of the ocean, where it is assumed that the temperature and pressure would presumably keep it down there, right? It's a sort of forced sequestering of this carbon dioxide at the bottom of the ocean. And you really only need to look at these exploding lakes to realize, well, there could be ways that that goes wrong, right? That's not necessarily something mm-hmm. we want to set ourselves up for.
Yeah.
So there really is no... There's no happy ending to this one. It's a really just sad phenomenon that we know is going to happen. It's just a question of when. And we should, you know, study it more. But there are no magic solutions to any of this stuff, I think.
No.
Yeah, I hope we don't add more carbon dioxide to the carbon dioxide problem. I mean, isn't that just like building a bigger bomb or fighting fire with fire? I don't know.
Right.
I'm mixing up my metaphors.
Yeah, no, it definitely seems like putting at the bottom of the ocean is a band-aid solution at best, right? Like, you don't need to be causing tsunamis on the coastline because you're trying to keep the water level from rising at the coastline. Next link?
Next link.
This one also comes to us from discovermagazine.com. It is titled, "The Earth is Pulsating Every 26 Seconds, and Seismologists Don't Agree Why."
Ooh.
Yeah. So every 26 seconds, the Earth shakes, and not a lot. It's not enough that you'd feel it, but this pulse or microseism in geologist lingo was first documented in the early 1960s by a researcher named Jack Oliver at the Lamont-Doherty Geological Observatory. And he figured out that the pulse was coming from somewhere in the southern or equatorial Atlantic Ocean, and that it was stronger in the northern hemisphere's summer months or in the southern hemisphere's winter.
Hmm.
So Mike Ritzwaller, a seismologist at the University of Colorado Boulder, explains that Jack didn't have the resources in 1962 that we had in 2005. He didn't have digital seismometers. He was dealing with paper records. Whereas in 1980, Gary Holcomb, a geologist with the U.S. Geological Survey, looked more closely at the weird microseism and figured out that it's strongest during storms. But his and Oliver's work would mostly be lost to time while this seismic drumbeat would just keep going on unnoticed beneath our feet. So one day in 2005, then graduate student Greg Benson was working with seismic data at his lab at the University of Colorado Boulder. And as Ritzwaller explains it, Benson pulled up some data and there it was, a strong signal coming from somewhere far off.
Hmm.
And they were actually able to triangulate the pulse to its origin, which was a single source in the Gulf of Guinea off the western coast of Africa. Fast forward 6 years, when another graduate student, Garrett Euler, came along, he narrowed down the source of the pulse even more to a part of the Gulf of Guinea called the Bight of Bonny. And he made a case for why waves hitting the coast were most likely the cause. So When waves travel across the ocean, the pressure difference in the water might not have a ton of effect on the ocean floor, but when it hits the continental shelf, where the solid ground is much closer to the surface, the pressure actually deforms the ocean floor and causes seismic pulses that reflect the wave action. But nearly 60 years after the pulse was first observed, no one has really managed to figure it out. And that might be just because, as far as seismologists are concerned, it's just not really a priority, apparently.
Yeah, not until we figure out that it's a major cause for XYZ disaster and it's been there warning us all this time.
That's right.
Or it turns out that this is technically Earth's heartbeat and it's a sentient being, blah, blah,
blah. It's slowing down.
Yeah. But Ritzwaller says that it doesn't mean that this isn't worth studying, though, and it may just be up to future generations of students, supposedly grad students, I'd assume. And
free labor.
to truly unlock these great enigmas.
And then not get credited for it.
I mean, this article did a pretty good job of name dropping some grad
students.
You know, I was impressed by
that. Super fair. Yeah. And including a quote by someone who's essentially gatekeeping meteorology.
Right.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Next link.
Next link.
All right. Well, this article is called Ancient Rocks Reveal When Earth's Plate Tectonics Began. And the study itself is pretty cool, and we'll get into that. But the most fascinating aspect of this article to me is that it goes into just how important plate tectonics are to the functioning of our planet. Because I had no idea. I thought plate tectonics was just kind of this inconvenient situation that causes earthquakes. But actually, a lot of scientists now think that without plate tectonics, we wouldn't have life on Earth at all.
Whoa, bold claim.
So when a planet is the right size and distance from its star to sustain life, astronomers call that the Goldilocks zone, right? But one of the things they don't talk about as much is that the Goldilocks zone moves as the star goes through its own life cycle. Stars get bigger and hotter as they age, so a planet that's in the Goldilocks zone today generally won't be there a billion years from now.
Right.
And yet, somehow, Earth has maintained a Goldilocks climate for at least 3.5 billion years. So one of the main reasons we've been able to achieve this is because of the carbon dioxide cycle. CO2 is a greenhouse gas, meaning it insulates the Earth and traps heat in. And obviously, when humans go and dump a bunch of extra CO2 into the atmosphere, it messes up this balance. But generally, what's supposed to happen is that there are natural chemical processes that add CO2 to the air, including the oxidizing of certain minerals, and then other processes that remove CO2, such as the formation of limestone with silicate minerals. And when the climate warms, it makes these silicate reactions more efficient, which removes more of our insulation material faster and basically thins out our winter jacket. And then when it cools, the removal of CO2 becomes less efficient and more of it builds up to keep us warm.
Okay.
And this sort of compensatory back and forth is part of what has kept Earth's temperature stable through these long fluctuations that go back and forth about every 100,000 years. But in order to keep the chemical reactions going, you need a steady supply of fresh silicate minerals for the air to react with. And these are largely found on the exposed sides of mountains, where two plates collide and push the underground supply of minerals upward and outward.
Ah, like tilling the earth, but in a sort of DIY kind of way.
In a really slow way. Yeah, exactly. And the formation of mountains is also what brings a steady supply of phosphorus to the surface, which is critical for fertilizing life. What's more, the circulation of liquid mantle under our crust is what causes Earth's magnetic field, which is what protects our atmosphere from being eroded away by solar storms.
Ooh.
And all of this combined makes a lot of scientists think that without plate tectonics, you could get life, but it wouldn't last very long because it would use up all its resources on the surface relatively quickly and have no way to tap into all that that's stored underneath. So to prove this theory, it's pretty critical for us to know when the cycle of moving surface plates began. Because if it was only, say, a billion years ago, then obviously life must have found another way to get going. But now geochemists Jonas Tusch and Karsten Munker say they've figured it out. They've pinpointed the time in our history when plate tectonics began. So Tusch and Munker focused on the isotope tungsten-182, which we know was formed from the radioactive decay of hafnium-182 within 60 million years of the solar system's formation. So basically, tungsten-182 should be relatively abundant in rocks from very early in Earth's history. But okay. after plate tectonics started, the churning of the mantle would have mixed up tungsten 182 with the other four isotopes of tungsten, creating rocks with uniformly low values of tungsten 182, according to them. That's okay. what they went looking for. And it took them 5 years, but eventually they gathered enough samples of prehistoric rocks from all over the world of different ages to show a really clear pattern. Lots of tungsten 182 up to 3.3 billion years ago, then a period of transition for about 200 million years, then consistently low modern levels of tungsten 182 from about 3.1 billion years onward. And the interesting thing to match up with that is that there was definitely life on Earth prior to 3.3 billion years ago. But mm-hmm. that window when plate tectonics began lines up perfectly with this explosive period where bacterial diversity went through the roof, photosynthesis began, the atmosphere Ooh. Started to become oxygenated, all of which made more complex forms of life possible. So they were mm-hmm. super thrilled with the results. They were like, this is exactly what we were hoping to find. This yeah. proves, you know, there was life, but plate tectonics is what really kicked us into high gear. And then actually, interestingly, after that, scientists say there was a period of stalling, which they call the boring billion, where the continents got jammed into the supercontinent Nuna Rodinia. And there wasn't a whole lot of tectonic activity for a while because they were all just sort of stuck in this traffic jam as one supercontinent. Mm-hmm. And Ming Tang of Peking University argues that during this time, the mountains eroded away completely, the surface of Earth was flat, the oxygen levels dropped, and it wasn't until the supercontinent broke apart and movement resumed that we then see the second great explosion of both oxygen and complex life in the fossil record.
Oh, man.
Yeah. So it all lines up. And it's like, okay, well, I guess we'll have to put up with a few earthquakes because clearly this is super important that, you know, the ground is cycling underneath us like this, albeit incredibly slowly.
Yeah. I mean, I always knew that, you know, volcanic eruptions, while destructive, can be incredibly helpful for not only creating landmass, but enriching it because of right. all of those nutrients and minerals that are then brought to the surface and mixed with the soil.
Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely critical, apparently. And unfortunately, all of this points to no life on Mars, either now or in the past, because Mars is too small to generate the interior pressure that would be needed for plate tectonics.
Oh, so, man.
Yeah, they're basically like, never happened, never gonna happen.
Well, but I mean, can humans and our infinite hubris synthesize or create artificial plate tectonics?
Yeah, put some sort of like nuclear bomb into the core of the planet and crack it up a little bit.
It seems like a real, you know, human kind of experiment to conduct, especially right. if we've got Elon Musk with his sights set on it.
Well, and yeah, it basically, if we want to seed it with an atmosphere on any large scale, it just means we have to do a lot of mining. So like if we yep. set up our own mines that are constantly bringing the necessary minerals up to the surface to keep a carbon dioxide cycle going, we could in theory do that. I mean, it's pretty fair to say that life on Mars is going to be inhospitable for a long time. You know, we're going to be yeah. in our little domes with our little climate controlled areas long, long before we ever get yeah. anything like a full planet atmosphere going. But, you know, it's yeah. an important thing to keep in mind. That at some point, yeah. we're going to need to break up the surface of the planet and start moving them around a little bit.
That is if we don't just suck it dry of all of its resources that we find useful here on Earth first.
Yeah, that's probably going to happen. All right. Well, that's going to wrap it up for this bonus episode. We hope you've enjoyed it. As always, if you like our podcast and want to support us, you can do so at patreon.com/daminteristingweek. In the meantime, my name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Weisper Chen.
And we hope you have a damn interesting week. Bye-bye.